Did you know nearly one-third of supplement consumers in the U.S. are unsatisfied with the current immune-supporting drinks on the market? Help your consumers get the products they want with Immuse, the novel, clinically researched postbiotic that activates our body's natural defenses at the cellular level for year-round immune support. Formulate with the immune health ingredients backed by 30-plus research studies. Learn more at immusehealth.com. That's Immuse, I-M-M-U-S-E, health.com.
Hey folks, thanks for tuning in to Taste Radio, the number one podcast for the food and beverage industry. I'm editor and producer Ray Lateef, and you're listening to episode 208, which features an interview with Bantam Bagels co-founders Nick and Elise Oleksak, who discuss the remarkable rise of their innovative brand, which was acquired in 2018 for $34 million. Just a reminder, if you like what you hear on Taste Radio, please share the podcast with friends and colleagues. And of course, we'd love it if you could review us on the Apple Podcasts app or your listening platform of choice. Now, if you're like me, you enjoy bagels with a schmear of cream cheese. Nick and Elise Oleksak figured out a way for folks like us to skip a step. The husband and wife team behind Bantam Bagels, Nick and Elise created a mini bagel pre-filled with your favorite accoutrement. Launched as a retail storefront in New York City's West Village, Bantam Bagels has since evolved into a sprawling platform brand with its products, which now include mini stuffed pancakes and egg bites, sold at major retailers such as Walmart, Safeway, Target, and Costco. The brand's bagels are also available in Starbucks pastry cases nationwide and regularly seen on shopping network QVC. Approximately 18 months ago, Nick and Elise sold their company to Lancaster Colony subsidiary T. Marzetti for $34 million. Yet they remain at the helm of day-to-day operations and say their passion and commitment to the brand and its growth remains as strong as ever. In the following interview, I spoke with the Oleksaks about their transition from Wall Street analysts to bagel entrepreneurs, the role that Shark Tank had on the brand's genesis and its rapid development, how they assessed opportunities to scale the brand, and why they said yes to everything. They also explain why cold emailing works and how to do it effectively, why investing in PR has been crucial to the brand's success, and why the timing was right to sell the company. Hey folks, it's Ray with Taste Radio. I'm on a call right now with Nick and Elise Oleksak, who are the co-founders of Bantam Bagels. Nick, Elise, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. I really appreciate it. Bagel Bites, you know, my first interaction with Bantam Bagel Bites. By the way, do you call them Bagel Bites or do you call them Bagel Balls?
We call them mini stuffed bagels, hidden on number three.
Okay. I like mini stuffed bagels better than the ones that I just said. So, mini stuffed bagels, my first interaction with them was at a Starbucks, and you see them in Starbucks cases all over America, and they are pretty fantastic products. And I got to ask, since you started in 2013, how many mini stuffed bagels have you made to this point?
Oh my gosh.
Oh, that's a good trivia question.
That is a really good question. I would say, oh geez. And now I'm trying to do math in my head while we're on the phone.
500 million.
Probably.
500 million. Incredible.
Give or take.
Wow. You know, I've talked to a lot of entrepreneurs who've never had a job. They are like, look, I'm going from college or right from high school and I'm starting my own business. I can't work for anyone else. It almost seems like entrepreneurship found you. You know, Shark Tank has a great influence in our society in getting people to start their own businesses. And I think there was a little bit of that with Bantam Bagels as well, right?
Absolutely. I think Shark Tank is a mechanism of absolute just sheer inspiration. You see ideas come to life, it gets your wheels turning. But something I would love to debunk just as we're talking and, you know, sharing advice or background is that just because you're an entrepreneur and you technically work for yourself, it's not to be remiss that we still work and live in a world. and a world is interconnected. Everything that we do, like when Nick and I approach business and Bantam, we approach every single person, the people who work for us, the people that we sell to, our customers like Target or Starbucks, all of those people are technically, you know, part our bosses, people we have to answer to. So when you treat business not as I'm on my own, I get to do anything I want, but rather a series of relationships that if you're good to your relationships are good to you in return. I think it's a more productive way to approach entrepreneurship. Yes, you do get to determine your own hours and where you actually sit in your office, but business doesn't exist without a series of relationships with people you sell to and people who you are buying from. And those can be some of the toughest bosses that you'll ever see in your life. So that's, you know, one thing to remember as people embark on running their own business, to really respect and develop every relationship that they have, even if it's somebody that you, like your co-packer, who is working for you, technically you pay them, but that's a really important relationship that you have to make sure is happy and functioning properly and is delivering, you know, so that you can get what you need to service your business. And then your question about Shark Tank, isn't it just so inspiring? You know, just, I think that Shark Tank turned the concept of taking an idea and bringing it to a business environment and turned it kind of sexy, because it was the first time that we saw that it was a way to, like, you know, own your own future or turn sort of those ruminations that you may have on the weekend into a livelihood. It certainly inspired us. And let me say, Nick was like the biggest fan. We were both the biggest fans at the beginning, but he was the idea guy. Every day, every week, he would be calling with the next best idea. And it wasn't until that one idea of Mini Stuff Bagels that had us both just on pause. This is our idea. We have to do it. And once we were able to develop a product that was actually as good as the concept seemed, we got real deal reactions from the external world that was telling us that this actually is a good business idea. And that was really what pushed us over the edge to make this thing happen. And by validation from the external world, I mean like polling friends, sampling people in our world, talking about the concept, raising money, having people support, getting press before we opened. We went out and we spun the concept around and we developed it in the external world and made sure that the external world accepted our concept before we just dove right into the deep end. And I do think that's an important thing to do before you just throw everything to the wind and dive in.
That's a really good point among a lot of really good points that you just made, Elise. The concept of leaping in with 2 feet right into the deep end is a scary prospect for a lot of entrepreneurs. I've talked to some that say that's the only way to do it. There was a bit of hedging your bets on your part, right? I mean, would you call it that in keeping your day jobs prior to going all in with Bantam?
I don't know if I would call it hedging our bets. I think there is some validation that you need to have to make sure that it is that great idea. You know, to Elise's point, sharing the product with people, getting them behind it, getting them so excited. But in terms of keeping our jobs, like when Bantam actually launched and we opened the shop, Elise was pregnant, you know, and I think it was more about how do we make sure that we have, you know, the means to support our now soon to be growing family and make sure that, you know, we're doing the right things by just ensuring that we have the support, you know, for our new baby that was on the way, which is why I kept my job and worked both for almost a year and a half, where I would be at the bakery in the morning before work and then at the bakery after work. Elise, you know, she quit her job and started running the shop full time. There's no set rubric or no set path to being a successful entrepreneur. I think you have to be able to be flexible, but you have to be able to be realistic in what matters.
But I also want to make sure it's clear that we were all in. I agree with you. Like entrepreneurs, you decide. We tested the concept and we validated that was a good concept, but then we went all in.
Yeah.
Just because Nick had a day job, every penny of our savings, every hour, minute, we never had weekends. We went 4 years to thinking, oh my God, people get paid to have 2 days off a week? Is this a joke? You know, like, we were all in, and I do agree with that. You have to heart hustle and absolutely bleed what you're doing. It's a different kind of commitment where it almost is like another extension of yourself. It's like it was our first child. Also, like with regards to raising capital, the very, very nanosecond that you take $1 from somebody else, you are all in. Oh, yeah. That pressure is so real deal that it's hard to even explain how real it is. And I think any successful entrepreneur has that burning feeling in their pocket when someone else's money goes in there and you're responsible for that money and turning it for them. That's an all-in kind of experience.
Totally. I'm sure there were a few folks who initially saw Bantam as a niche concept. There's a lot of niche concepts, a lot of niche foods in New York City, and they can work in New York City because it's a densely populated place, and you can have a shop that sells literally one thing, and it'd be a huge success. At what point did you realize of an opportunity, there was an opportunity to scale Bantam? And how did you think about the ways you could do it? How did you think about the ways you could expand, as in more retail stores, you know, packaged products, food service? Eventually you did all of them, but you know, what did you think about, you know, the process of what should we do first?
So like any entrepreneur, we had our sights on the world, anywhere and everywhere, and we were willing to throw everything against the wall until it stuck, right? In order to get there. But the truth is, when we first started this out, we didn't see mini stuffed bagels as a niche concept. We saw it as a lifestyle change. And the way that we went on developing this brand was to approach it as a lifestyle brand. So while our competitors in New York City, like at the time, the Krona was the most famous one, and there were other single food restaurants at the time, they were all, you know, going after Bon Appetit or like food-based forums. We actually took a different approach and we said, we're changing, you know, our mantra at the time was change the way America bagels. Let's change the way that people eat an iconic food. And so that is more of a lifestyle change. Like, of course, we had to make sure our product was so delicious that you wanted to come back for more. And we had our authentic credibility in our New York City roots. But when we went on to develop a lifestyle brand, we started approaching magazine outlets, Us Weekly, Oprah's magazine. We developed a catering program for Condé Nast. We sponsored different Hamptons events. We wanted to be associated with a lifestyle of being able to reassociate bagels with something that was cool and worth eating in your regular everyday life, not something that's unapproachable and makes me want to die. I can't eat dinner tonight because I just had a bagel today. So that was how we approached it, not as a niche brand, but as we were developing a brand new way of eating something that was iconic.
Mike, I heard you're starting a beverage company.
Ray, let's say I was. Do you have any suggestions for a complete partner?
Absolutely. Ingredion. Ingredion is a leading global plant-based ingredient solutions provider to the food and beverage industry. With a diverse portfolio, including sweeteners and sugar reduction technologies, plant-based proteins, starches, and hydrocolloids.
Of course. Ingredients 360 Value Framework delivers value according to your brand's specific needs through consumer well-being, environmental impact, and value creation. Ingredients market research and insights for innovation can help uncover opportunities within the beverage space. For instance, figuring out what added health benefits consumers need. They have a network of technical experts that will help you solve your pain points to get you to market faster. With Ingredient, you gain a partner who helps you deliver the total beverage experience that keeps consumers coming back.
To learn more about Ingredient, head to tasteradio.com/beverage.
The New Beverage Showdown returns to BevNet Live in New York City on June 12th and 13th. Pitch your beverage startup in front of a panel of expert judges, our live audience, and viewers tuning into the live stream. To learn more, visit bevnetlive.com.
What you're talking about is PR, public relations, really getting your message out there, getting it to the right outlets, getting people talking about your brand and your products.
Yeah.
Oftentimes, PR is overlooked, especially with early stage brands, early stage entrepreneurs. It's expensive. Why did you feel the need? I mean, what compelled you to invest in PR early on?
Honestly, I think we felt like there was so much to this idea that we wanted to do it right from the beginning. And, you know, you asked the question of like, kind of how did we know what the next step for the business would be and where should we go next? And I think the fact that we had Erica, who's our publicist, you know, and she's been our publicist from day one, the fact that we had her bringing the brand out into the marketplace in a unique and different way, to Elise's point, allowed us to make those decisions in a much more strategic, analytical way than if we didn't have someone who was sharing the brand with the media, getting the brand out there, you know, allowing our story to grow in both like the conventional media channels, but also in like a very holistic way, like through blogs and Instagram and influencer posts. Like having that public relations side to growing a business, we knew we had to do it. We knew from the very beginning we had to have an outlet to share what we were doing, because what we were doing was so different and unique. Like no one had done this before with such an iconic food. We knew that we needed the support to get it out beyond New York City. And I think that is when we realized we needed to get the product beyond New York City. You know, we were getting all of this national media exposure and this buzz around the brand and the product. And there was just such a demand to get it outside of that little retail shop in the West Village and to go, you know, explore the wholesale route. You know, our first major wholesale customer was QVC. And we baked all the bagels for QVC out of that small little bakery. It was insane. We were running 24-hour baking shifts. Like it was madness, but we got that opportunity because we had got placement in Specialty Food Magazine. And that's where the QVC buyer saw it. And that's how she called our phone to ask us if we could get her 30,000 bagels 2 weeks after that. That was driven so much by, you know, our focus on PR and our focus on spreading the brand, spreading awareness of what the product does and what we were trying to do. So I think as you look at entrepreneurs, maybe PR isn't on the top five list of things to include when you start, but from our perspective, it had to be. And I think it changed the way that the brand grew, and it allowed us to be in a lot more places a lot faster than if we didn't have it.
Getting into places a lot faster helps when you are running 24-hour shifts and baking bagels all the time. Yeah.
Well, you got to get the sale and the demand before you can create the supply when you're on a budget. Yeah. So you got to elicit that demand, and marketing is not to be overlooked. Everybody thinks if I build it, they will come. But the truth is, when you build it, they often don't come unless you tell them to come. And we didn't have enough money to invest in advertising, and PR is so organic. It's like the voice of a trusted person is spreading your word for you. And there's nothing more organic and authentic than, you know, like the news or, you know, articles.
Absolutely. I want to go back to your storefront. And were you baking everything in that little storefront, or did you have a separate operation?
We were baking every single bagel until 2015 in that bakery.
That is incredible.
Looking back on it, it is also terrifying how small that place was, and what we were able to do in those four walls is just, you know, it really is a feat that we really just have to thank our team and our staff, you know, who helped us in the beginning. They just believed in us and believed in the product. And, you know, they were willing to work part of those 24-hour shifts and, you know, be part of what we felt was just this amazing, crazy energy of just like continuing to do everything we could to get the product out there. So it was pretty wild and scary and fun. But I mean, I think that's what makes starting a business and growing it quickly, you know, that's what makes it exciting, is having the opportunities to have to run a 24-hour shift and have to, you know, bring in new people and asking employees if they have any friends who, you know how to roll out dough and just crazy stuff. You know, and looking back on it, that's another thing, starting with that little retail shop, it gave us the ability to get to market so much faster than if we had to take time and go find, you know, a commercial kitchen or a secondary baking location. You know, we could say yes to opportunities, I think, a lot faster because we did have, you know, the ability to bake the product in the retail shop.
You had an infrastructure. You had a very small infrastructure, but you did have an infrastructure.
We had it. Right. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And, you know, when I think about Bantam, I'm reminded of an interview that I did with another New York-based entrepreneur, Siggy Holmarsson, who's the founder of Siggy's Yogurt, or is it Siggy's Skier, to be more precise. And he said that, you know, it's really important for entrepreneurs to build the infrastructure for success. You have to know what success looks like and know how what you're doing today can scale. at that point in 2015, when you were running 24/7 and had, you know, massive orders coming through, when did you realize that you needed to adjust that infrastructure, to build upon that infrastructure? And how much of that was planning for 1 year versus, say, 5 years down the line?
Yeah, it was basically like July of 14 is when we were like, oh my God, we need a bigger boat, because we were notified that we had just gotten Oprah's favorite things list. And that list publishes at the end of October. And we had filmed Shark Tank. And
we were going to film Shark Tank. And what happened was, yes, when we were preparing for Shark Tank, we watched every episode that had ever aired. And we wrote down every question. And we prepared every answer. And what had emerged in a lot of the historical Shark Tank episodes was this concept of a co-man. We had never heard of it. Our initial business plan, if we showed it to you from 7 years ago, actually had Bantam becoming a franchise. So total different school of thought. And we were getting all this demand that was not associated with the shop. You know, people were coming to the shop, but the demand was in other people's doors, like QVC or other retailers. So Shark Tank gave us the idea of a co-man. And we looked at each other and we were like, oh my God, we cannot stand in front of the sharks and pitch without having done some research on a co-man. So we spent weeks leading up to the pitch, calling Johnny, Frank, every bagel guy in New York City. I mean, there is no repository, or like Google does not have a list of co-manufacturers. Let me tell you that much. You have to know a guy who knows a guy who doesn't wear shoes half the time, who, you know, so through our New York connections and just being people who learn as we go and talk to everybody and use relationships, you know, as one of the most important parts of business, we managed. Actually, I was walking into bagel shops around New York City. I would just walk around the city, walk into bagel shops and talk to the managers and ask for their, where do you guys bake? Do you bake everything here? And we started calling up different factories. One thing led to another. And we ended up finally finding the right co-man who was willing to bake our bagels for us. But, you know, our customers led us to changing our business model, which we listened to the customers. They wanted us elsewhere. And a new business model meant we needed to learn how to service that. We had no idea or plans for a co-manufacturer, but we figured it out from different mediums, learning from Shark Tank, learning from Johnny, you know, Frank, the bagel guy. And that's really how we landed on our infrastructure for expansion.
You know, this is the hustle I'm talking about, you know,
yeah.
knocking on every door, picking up, calling every phone. You know, that's what it takes. And, you know, I'm sure you're going to get a lot of doors slammed in your face and a lot of people who want nothing to do with you. But after that 100th call, that 100th, you know, door, it might work. It might have all paid off.
Exactly.
I want to go off on a tangent real quick, because I'm sure going and talking to a lot of folks about this idea might have been kind of scary, because you're worried about somebody taking that idea. How much of your bagel was protected by intellectual property? I mean, did you get a patent on the stuffed bagels?
So when we first got the idea, we Googled feverishly, because we were like, I mean, this has to, a mini stuffed bagel like this, just, we can't be the first ones. And, you know, we Googled around and there was nothing like what we were doing. So we were like, well, how do we make sure this is protected? How do we make sure that, you know, someone doesn't come on and knock us off? And food is just so hard to get like an actual patent on. I mean, we filed a provisional patent on, you know, the process that we used, you know, to make the product and just to make us feel better about it, that we were at least doing something from, you know, an IP protection standpoint. But honestly, with food, and this is kind of the three things that we've said from the very beginning, in order to grow and build a successful food brand on a unique item, is you have to be first, best, and biggest. And, you know, that was really just how we looked at it from the very beginning, is we have to be the first to market. We have to have the best product that anyone's ever had. And we have to work our butts off to make it the biggest brand that we can make it before someone comes along in a meaningful way and tries to knock us off. You know, so that goes back to kind of your question around infrastructure and planning and, you know, how do you see, you know, 2 years in the future when you're on the 11th hour of your 12th hour of a baking shift? But, you know, for us, it was really always looking those next steps ahead to make sure that we were prepared as we were trying to make this the biggest thing we could so that we could say yes to those opportunities.
Right. And we always said that our best defense, even talking to our attorneys, our best defense was always to be the first, the biggest, and the best. And each one of those is like equally as important. And so it's like Nick said, that's part of where that hustle comes from, because you're racing against time to be the biggest. You might already be the best. You might already be the first, but if you don't have that third item, you know, of also being the biggest, once a competitor attempts to strike, then it's over.
Going back to the QVC deal, you know, that's an interesting retail avenue, or that's an interesting sales opportunity for brands. And I'm seeing more food brands pop up on that network, more than I guess I had been paying attention to. I wonder if QVC was looking at you as, okay, this is the first, this is the best we've seen. Did you think about, you know, a QVC as a real sales opportunity for the brand?
Yeah, they approached us. I mean, they saw an article about our product in Specialty Food Magazine, and literally we got a call from the main buyer at QVC. She started the conversation by being, I'm going to be upfront with you. We are a very big organization and we have a lot of set rules and we're not easy to deal with sometimes, but if you guys can fit your product and your pricing within our models, we can be successful together. That was literally how the conversation started. And she was like, we would put an order of like 30,000 bagels and we would need it in 2 weeks. Is that something you think you could do? And we were like, yeah, absolutely. No problem. And then like hung up the phone, looked at each other. We were like, oh my God, how are we actually going to do this? Because to your point, like we had no idea that QVC sold food. You know, in our minds growing up, QVC was, you know, the place to go and get, you know, clothing and jewelry and like, you know, dry goods, and food never crossed our minds, you know, of being an avenue to sell there. And they are our longest standing customer. Our first airing was March of 2014. So we've been on there for 6 years.
Wow. Why have you kept going back on? I mean, is it just because sales have just been great?
Honestly, it's the sales are great. And what is so meaningful about QVC is the actual interaction and relationship that you have with your customer. The QVC customer trusts you and trusts your product and trusts your brand so much that to continue to go back and just really talk to them and, you know, give them updates on the business and what you're doing and maybe some new products or new flavors that you have. I mean, it's been such an amazing outlet and channel for us as the business has grown to kind of continue to be really, really customer facing in a way that is super unique, you know, to any other way that we sell our product.
Was there any hesitation to partner with QVC when they first called you? I mean, Elise, before we jumped on the mics, you had mentioned that, you know, a key to your success or key to Bantam Bagel's success to this point has been saying yes to everything. But was there any hesitation when they came knocking?
No, it was a deal and we wanted to take it. I mean, we were the energy and I mean, we were just catapulting forward. There was no no's. It was saying yes to everything. I mean, like Nick told you, we said yes. We took 2 weeks, 24-hour shifts. We overhauled our basement with freezers. We had Nick driving out to Long Island freezer space when those got full to drive the rest of the inventory out there. We Googled nutrition facts and figured out how to put a nutrition fact on a package. We have always been very opportunistic. And when there's an opportunity in your hand and you're just starting out as an entrepreneur, you have big visions, you got to just figure it out and get it to work. I think profitability is important to us now, but at the very, very beginning stages, it was about getting bagels in people's mouths and getting our brand out there. And we figured, okay, this first run might like run us to the ground, but the second run will get a little bit better. And the third round we'll get a co-man doing. And the fourth round, you know, we'll have a printer that will print these nutrition facts and we won't be hand stickering, you know, so we had confidence in ourselves that we would be able to find the profits when the time came. But, you know, we didn't want to be so myopic as to get in our own way of opportunity.
Mike, I was just in the kitchen and I saw this really cool THC-infused beverage brand called Eighth Wonder.
Ah, chill brand. They make cannabis bevs as well as beer and spirits. The product you're talking about is a super tasty cherry limeade cannabis seltzer called Lil Bit. And did you know Eighth Wonder was acquired last year by Houston's BioCity Hemp?
Yes, I did. That deal created a world-class, vertically integrated cannabis and craft beverage company. Bayou's science-based processes for extracting THC from hemp have made the company the gold standard for cannabis products across Texas and beyond.
Bayou's cannabis portfolio includes 8th Wonder as well as Howdy and Beach Break, all of which are distributed throughout Texas and Louisiana.
You can learn more about all these brands at 8thWonder.com, SipHowdy.com, and SipBeachBreak.com.
On June 12th and 13th in New York City, hear from Icelandic Glacial, Lemon Perfect, GoPuff, Sachet, Diageo Ventures, and Lowe's Foods during the leading event for the beverage industry. Save on BevNet Live tickets through April 26th. Just visit BevNetLive.com.
Say yes to everything, a core tenant of the business. Work your butt off, another core tenant. There's another, we'll call it an adage, that I've seen associated with Bantam, which is fake it till you make it. And that's, you know, prevalent in the food and beverage industry, that notion of we've got to make it look like we're making it until we actually do. But I think it's a misunderstood phrase sometimes. I mean, what does it mean to you guys?
I think it means present the product and the brand in a way that people will say yes to you. Present yourself in a way where you show up like you are backed by this 24-hour, 7-day-a-week production facility, that you are, you know, you are the brand that they can rely on to stock their shelves, to, you know, be the product that can meet the partnership, like with a retailer. You know, like when we did our first retailer sell-in, it was out in, you know, the West Coast in like 2016, I think. And we, again, had never done retail before. We didn't really understand the landscape, but we went in with confidence. We went in that we could be the product that, you know, they needed, and it worked, and we sold in. And I think it was just like that first taste of just having this confidence in how the product can be successful and kind of sharing that with the people that you're pitching, or, you know, the potential partnerships that you may be going into business with, I think is kind of how we look at, I guess, the fake it till you make it adage, is, you know, really doing everything you can to present yourself that you can handle anything, and then figuring out how to actually handle it if the opportunity comes through.
While we may have presented, yes, we got this, and then behind the scenes been learning as we take that next step and been growing along with our growth, at the same time, we've never let a customer down. We've never, literally in 3 years, 8,000 stores plus 500 million bagels, shorted an order, missed production, you know, fallen short on anything that we've promised. So I do think, like, maybe the fake it till you make it wouldn't be well received if you don't deliver on what you're promising.
Yeah.
We never promise something that we don't literally fall on our sword to make happen.
That's a great point. And, you know, going back to Starbucks, I'm sure you have to convince them that you're willing to do literally anything, but that you also have the ability to follow through on those orders, that you do have some redundancies in production in case something goes wrong.
And here are some ways that we showed them. So they knew what our production was at the time. We were working incredibly closely, and they knew that we would need to ramp up actual capacity in order to meet their needs. But we proved to them through almost a year of working together, through smaller scale rollouts, we proved to them that we could keep up every step of the way and that we were smart enough to actually do good on our word. For example, when we were in just 3 stores, Nick and I spent every single day of the week for 2 weeks straight sampling in those stores, going from every store, printing out signs for them, talking to the baristas, toasting up bacon goudas for serving them behind the counter. And then when we went into 50 stores, we did the very same thing. We dedicated our heart and soul into that deal, and we showed them what we were willing to put in if they were willing to lean in for us as well. And we pulled everything off every step of the way. When we expanded into 500 stores and we were in 3 different cities, we actually put our 2-year-old at the time on a plane. We like scrounged up some airline miles. We had no money at the time, and literally went to Indianapolis, every single store with the baby, chatting the baristas, going behind, sampling. And this was what we did on our own. We went to every store in New York City, every store in Indy, and every single store in Philly, just showing them that we were going to ooze the sort of authenticity and passion that would like make a difference of having the product in their case. And it worked out, having sort of like performance measures of showing them this passion and showing them this dedication allowed them to have a trust in us that once we did actually get launched in the full nationwide system, that we would be pulling this off. There was no way we were going to mess it up by that time.
Mess it up, you did not. That's amazing to hear that you didn't miss a single order. You haven't missed a single order in the 3 years that you've been in Starbucks. I want to go back into your first sale at Starbucks. It's an interesting story about how you first got connected to a Starbucks buyer. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So when we were first, you know, looking at what are the opportunities for the brand and the product, how do we really impact the rest of this country? How do we get the product into larger wholesale distribution channels? Like, what can we do? Literally every 2 weeks, Elise and I would go and make a list of where we thought would be a great place that could sell Bantam Bagels. And then we would go on LinkedIn and we would look up that company. And then we would try to guess the email address of the people in the food and beverage space. And if we didn't get a bounce back, we knew we guessed the email right. And then we'd blast them all out with our story, who we were, with the product, and hope that we'd get a response. And we did this for literally every major food company or place that would sell food you can think of. We did that. And we did it with Starbucks. And we got an email back from their regional director in New York City. His name was Chris Flett. And Chris wrote us an email and said, "Hey, you know, so nice to hear from you. I actually know you guys. I saw you on Shark Tank. Funny story. We're actually thinking about doing a regional product rollout, maybe in New York City, where I think this could, you know, work really well. And also, whenever we have people come in from outside of New York, we bring them downtown to three places: our Starbucks on Christopher Street, Bantam Bagels on Bleecker, and our Starbucks on Bleecker." He's like, "So I think there may be something here." And that was it. That's how the relationship started. You know, we obviously had more meetings with them after that to get everything set up, but it was really just us trying to do whatever we could, reaching out to whoever we could to make sure that the brand and the product succeeded.
Were you raising money during this time as well?
Everything was self-funded, bootstrapped. We had our, you know, initial friends and family round to just even open the retail shop in the city. And then obviously we did the deal on Shark Tank. But outside of that, everything was just self-funded on us just continuing to, you know, to grow the business and run the business in a healthy way.
You know, hindsight's 20/20, but looking back, when you did the Shark Tank deal, it was for $275,000 in exchange for 25% of the company. Now, the company was sold in 2018, Bantam Bagels, for $34 million. So looking back, was that a good deal for you at the time? And, you know, do you think it's still a good deal?
100%. Yeah. And we get that question, or a variation of that question a lot. And I think our answer has never changed. Shark Tank changed our business in a way that is so meaningful that I don't think there is a storyline where we wouldn't do what we did.
Shark Tank was so much more than PR. It was a connection with customers, a real deal connection where they rooted for us. They watched us walk down the hallway. They watched us hug Lori, and they watched our success and growth afterwards. And they followed along. Like, having people who genuinely care and root for your brand is literally one of the most invaluable assets that we've acquired along the way. And I think Lori is a tremendous partner. That connection with customers, that real, genuine, authentic connection, I don't know that we would have been able to forge without Shark Tank. Like, we feel forever indebted to it. We have always believed that, like, 100% of zero is zero. And if you're an entrepreneur and think that you're just going to hold on to your whole business, I don't know how far you can go. Business is nothing but a series of relationships, and you need to be smart about which relationships you bring into your family. But when you bring the right people in and you make the right deals, that is the game changer for a business. So to us, it wasn't even about the percentage. It was about, this was the right person in the right format that was creating the right customer environment for us.
At the right time.
At the right time. And it sincerely, like, made the difference of our entire, you know, company's growth that we rely on even now. Like, those customer connections still mean a lot to us as we forge new grocery stores, as we expand innovation. Having a business that people root for is really, really, really unique and really, really hard to create.
So for as much success and organic success as you had, I mean, certainly, you know, you've had some big opportunities with QVC, with Starbucks, with Shark Tank, but it sounds like everything has been going exceedingly well. So why sell the company?
Because business is relationships. Business is more than just what we're able to do. Like, we were growing too fast for Nick and Elise to be able to prop it up. We needed infrastructure that was bigger than we had the capability of creating in a shorter amount of time than we had the ability to create it. Our line, even at the co-man, was exploding with capacity. And at this point, you know, we were looking for a true, true partner. We weren't looking to say whether we wanted a capital raise or sell. That wasn't part of what we were looking for. We were looking for someone who was willing to lean in, who had sort of like the left side to our right side. And that was exactly what Marzetti had. And people who were willing to keep the culture and the vibrancy and like what made Bantam tick alive. Once you end up going on the, you know, going on a capital raising program, like we had a banker and we were looking for capital, you meet a lot of people and you learn that personality and fit actually supersedes even like what the deal structure is. Because at the end of the day, this is your baby and you want it to succeed and you want to lead it to success. And that's what we found in Marzetti. It was incredible. Like, we had all of these synergies in our culture, and they wanted to preserve the way that we worked, the way that we sold, the way that we thought. They had easy access to manufacturing. You know, we needed a new packaging line. This is all boring stuff, but it was stuff that we didn't have the capital to create. We didn't know how to develop, but they had the teams in place. They had the engineers, you know, all of that sort of like back office stuff that isn't our strong suit and that we would take a long time for us to learn and grow on our own. They had it easily accessible. So it was more about like finding this match made in heaven than sell, don't sell, raise, don't raise. Like, we wanted the best for this business. We have a vision. We're still not done. We're still running the show. It just happens to be under a different structure, but to us, it really doesn't make a difference.
Does it help to have a partner like that when you're thinking about your own personal lives? I mean, you have a family, you have two young kids. Does the deal give you that kind of flexibility to spend more time with your family, to be a little bit more present at home, or is it still 24/7?
We're still working our hardest. Like, we're still grinding, we're still on flights, we're still leading the business. But I think what weighed more heavily on our family was as we grew and as more and more weight and more just like financial weight was on our shoulders, that weight is so heavy just on you physically, mentally, anxiety. It's a lot to carry. And to, you know, as a family, like, it's hard to have your work and your life really merge into one as an entrepreneur. And obviously that anxiety and that heaviness and that weight will seep into your family life. So it's less about like hours in the day that are changed. It's more about, we don't put the kids to bed and then lay awake at night staring at the ceiling saying, oh my God, what's going to happen next? Or like, oh my God, what fire are we going to put out tomorrow? We have a feeling of safety that like I could only have dreamt of before. We know that Marzetti has our backs when we have problems. You know, they're right there to help us. We work hand in hand with the chief strategist there who solves every single problem with us. So we have a third opinion. We don't just have to rely on our gut anymore. And I think just that security, forget the financial piece of the security, just like the knowing that you have people who have your back and they have access to things that we otherwise would have had to invent or create from scratch is like a peace of mind that is definitely has transcended into our family.
This has been a rock star conversation. I mean, I feel like you guys are rock star entrepreneurs. I don't use that word very often. I really loved every minute of our conversation, of our talk. Thank you so, so much for taking the time to speak with me. And let's try to meet up when we have an opportunity, because I'd love to meet you guys in person.
That would be great.
Yes,
yeah.
I mean, I would too.
We, once all of this craziness and unprecedented times, you know, hopefully abates and we can all kind of go back to some semblance of normal, we'll definitely be up and around the Boston area. So that would be awesome.
Outstanding. I'd love to have a bagel and coffee with you guys.
Yeah, done. That sounds awesome. Well, thank you for your time and you know, for talking to us. It always, you know, it means a lot for us to be able to kind of share our story. And thank you.
Well, you are thoroughly welcome. Much appreciated.
That brings us to the end of episode 208. Thank you so much for listening. And thanks to our guests, Nick and Elise Oleksak. You can catch both Taste Radio and Taste Radio Insider on tasteradio.com, the Apple Podcasts app, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. As always, for questions, comments, ideas for future podcasts, please send us an email to ask@tasteradio.com. On behalf of the entire Taste Radio team, thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.